Welcome to the Human Advisor Podcast. This series is brought to you by Altruist, the first ever fully integrated digital brokerage platform for fiduciary financial advisors. No commissions, no fees, and no biases. The way it should be. Check out humanadvisorpodcast.com for new episodes. Now let's get into today's episode.
My name is Tyrone Ross, host of the Human Advisor Podcast. First things first, go to the YouTube page, hit subscribe, where you'll be able to watch the full-length conversation that I had with Desarte Yarnway, CEO and founder of Burknell Financial. Burknell Financial is a firm that Desarte started to work with the people of San Francisco, has a large startup community that he advises, but more importantly, as you'll see on our walk and talk, as Desarte talked about his roots here in San Francisco, why he brought his firm back here, and why he serves the people that he serves. Here are the highlights from that conversation. Enjoy.
Being a black advisor, you really have to be conscious of how you move your chess pieces on the board. Me being in the financial district around Wells, Chase, and all these other places does me a disservice. But me making a home away from that and making it comfortable, having a parking be free, people appreciate that.
Thanks for this. This is beautiful, man. This is awesome. Why San Francisco? Why is it a fit for your practice? But more importantly, why is it a fit for you and who you serve?
When I think about San Francisco in terms of it fitting my practice, I think about two words. Those words are going to be progressive and inclusive, right? Mm-hmm. San Francisco is a sanctuary city. People are coming here to experience the better things in life if they can. Right. And it seems as though since the 1960s, there's always been space for folks, right?
Okay.
That want to grow their self professionally, right? Mm-hmm. That want to grow families. My parents came here at a time when they could do that, right?
Right.
And then I think that I am, an example of somebody who is trying to do the same thing being in our communities. We don't have a lot of black people here.
Right.
Right. 3% black population, maybe 6% Latino population. Right. So being here is a statement in itself, saying that I'm here to help you do what we all want to do, which is create that multi-generational wealth, which create equity in our, not only our bank accounts, but in our values as well.
Right.
And I think San Francisco presents me with a perfect opportunity to do that across the board, no matter what your complexion is.
Right. Now, again, so just playing devil advocates here and push it back
as you
a
always
little bit.
Do.
Right. You know it. So I'm a young black advisor that's following you on Twitter, right? And I'm in Atlanta, or I'm in Detroit, or I'm in D.C., right? Like, why wouldn't, you know, you try and put a focus there where there's where there's more of us? Like you said, there's 3% of us here where the numbers are greater, right? In Atlanta, in the South, why not there? And again, I know your roots are here, so it makes sense. But, you know, what would you say to that young brother that's trying to come up, or that young sister trying to come up and build their practice where they are?
I would say that you can serve people everywhere. Being black and being around a lot of black folks makes sense, and it's a good thing to do, and you're going to make impact there. But I think that being in a place like San Francisco, where it's so diverse, you have the ability to serve your people and people of color, minorities that are experiencing the same things as us, right?
Right.
So although the complexion, the melanin may be at different levels, right?
Yeah, right.
They're
right.
still experiencing a lot of the things that we do. So now when we can kind of get in between that color barrier, we're speaking the same language. And I think that is so impactful. And that helps not only, it creates depth and breadth. That was a dolphin. Depth and breadth. Yeah, it's an otter or a dolphin. That creates depth and breadth with the impact that I'm going to make in this city and beyond.
Love it.
So after Desarte showed me around and we walked and talked a bit, we came back to his office to get a little bit deeper into his practice and a little bit more about he enjoys working with young professionals in the area. Enjoy. All right, welcome. We are here on set.
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks for, you know, taking the time, man, and having me here.
Thank you.
Right?
Welcome to my humble abode.
Yeah, this is incredible, man. Great vibe, great city, great time. Again, this is a powerful thing for me as a friend,
right?
As a fellow advisor. Yep. You know, it's special with you being an author, podcast host, Desarte Yarnway, everybody.
Thank you, man.
This is incredible. Again, thanks for welcoming us here and having us. I think this is going to be a powerful conversation. Again, I just really want to, you know, kick it with you as friends and obviously dig a little deeper some things, but
there's so many, you know, facets to our right. conversations and the way we talk and what we talk about. But let's just start from the beginning, man. Tell me about Little Desarte.
Before we even get there, man, I feel like this is a full circle moment.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Because
last year I made it a point to myself to give myself birthday gifts every year. Right.
Right.
I give Burknell a birthday gift. And last year's gift was the Young Money podcast. And you were my first episode
right.
on that podcast. So to have you here in my office, right? At that point, I didn't have an office. At that point, I was kind of like still trying to figure out, did I belong in this space?
Right.
Doing this by myself, right? Mm-hmm. I ran through a couple partners. They just didn't have, the skin to commit. Yeah. And I wanted to rebrand myself, but also just step out on faith to really see what God could do in my career and my business. So
yeah.
you being on my podcast, now, you know, we have all these episodes. We've been speaking on the same stages.
It's incredible, man. It's incredible.
I mean, you're
it's
stepping
incredible.
Into all these opportunities and being blessed to have you here in San Francisco, to me, means a lot.
Awesome.
So thank you.
Yeah, no doubt, man. No doubt, man. This is an incredible moment.
For sure.
So yeah, let's just start it. I mean, obviously, there's so much to dig into, you know, a lot of what people will see, but let's just get to the roots of you being here, having your practice here, but just talk about, you know, growing up and what made you you.
Yeah, man. I think that a lot of our history is written well before we even hit our mother's wombs, right? So we come out of the womb with these like traumas, these experiences, and these responsibilities,
not even
knowing, right? So where should I start? In 1979, my mom came from Liberia. My dad came maybe in 1977, a couple of years old before she did, right?
Yeah. Straight here to San Fran?
Or? Straight here. So I think my dad might have stopped in Philly. There's a couple of different cities that are like housing Italy, Liberians, right?
Okay.
As everywhere. In New York, you got a huge Caribbean population.
Yep.
So a lot of them will gravitate to family and friends that they know in those places, right? Yeah, your dad being one of them. So my parents actually, I call them the strongest Liberians because they came from Liberia, hit the East Coast, and then decided to manifest destiny westward, you know, and come all the way to California.
Right.
So that's what they did. They met each other here in San Francisco through an organization called the Liberian Community of Northern California, in which my dad was the president at that time, a nonprofit that was solely focused on giving resources back to Liberia and bringing refugees from Liberia to safe spaces in the United States.
Wow.
Right. So my dad headed that mission.
Jeez.
So in doing that, you know, I kind of learned a lot about my family. My mom escaped Liberia in 1979, 80, right before what was called a rice riot or a coup.
Okay.
The first coup in Liberia, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to overthrow the government there and pretty much go crazy. Actually, my dad's tribe, the Gil tribe, was really one of the main people that they were trying to exterminate in Liberia. So they came and they moved into a small house with some family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like five married couples in one house.
Wow.
Right. And I talked to my mom just the other day. She was telling me like, D, if you want to get married and do all this stuff, we talked about our personal experiences of life.
Yeah.
Me and your dad, we went to what was equivalent to the dollar store back then.
Yes, sir.
Got pots and pans, one pot, two plates, two bowls, and we made it work. Finally, when they scrapped their pennies up together, I joked with my mom. She used to work at this San Francisco staple called Doggy Diner.
No.
Right. And she was like, I was making like $1.70 an hour.
Right.
And we made it work. So you have no excuse. We moved to this place called the Geneva Towers, which I was telling you about on the walk.
Yeah.
Worst living conditions, Marcy-like structures. There were two buildings, A and B. Right. And we lived on the top floor, 20th floor apartment, A and B we had. And we housed like 60 Liberians, man, from the war. I was born in that building. And this was a place that it was drugs ran rampant in the building. A lot of criminal activity, a lot of fights. As I was telling you, people were getting thrown off the balcony, hitting the ground and dying. You know what I mean? I remember my sister telling me a story about them being in the elevator. And they thought somebody was sleeping. When the elevator stopped, the dude just fell over. When it opened, he was dead. You know?
Right.
So coming from Liberia in a civil war,
right.
That's like, okay, this isn't that bad.
Right.
But, you know.
Right.
This isn't that bad.
Perspective
goes a long way.
Real talk.
This
Real
isn't
talk.
That bad, but to think that that's where I was born and that was the starting point of my family's generational wealth in this country puts a lot of responsibility on my back, right?
Right.
So after that, my parents, you know, figured it out. They bought a small home in that same neighborhood because they were breaking down those towers.
Yeah.
Because it was just too bad. The crime was too much for the city. So they broke it down, hoping that that would help. And I told you the story about the first day in that house, a drug dealer came to our house and asked for the former owner of the house because I guess he owned
the guy some money.
Yeah.
His car was still parked outside and he wasn't there. Obviously, we purchased the house and he lit the car on fire right in front of the house. Wow. So that was kind of like the conditions that my parents dealt with to, right. to give us a chance to be people in this country, right?
Right.
Fast forward, man, I think there are some impactful, there are moments in our lives that really define us as human beings. Like, if it wasn't for this, I never would have had the ambition. If it wasn't for this, I never could have seen myself in this seat. If it wasn't for this, I probably wouldn't have seen myself, you know, outside of football or outside of track, right?
Yeah,
you can get to that. You can, like, go back and you trace the genealogy to these moments where it's like, this was the point right here, right? Mm-hmm. So that moment for me, I think it was like in 1998, my father was diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer. Christmas Eve, decided to keep the news from our family because he didn't want to spoil the holiday season. So when he finally told my mom, he and the family, he said that the doctors diagnosed me with terminal prostate cancer, terminal meaning that there's no way that they can kind of reverse this, and they're giving me 6 months to live, right? So I want to say, like, that might have been 97 or my math might be wrong, but my dad lived 7 years after that. Fighter, you know what I mean? Like, it's in my blood to fight, coming from a civil war, coming from like a village in Liberia, you know, no running water, no nothing. You got to go to the water and draw from the well,
right?
Doing all those things and coming here and fighting 7 years with terminal prostate cancer. In my mind, that's when my childhood stopped and I became a man.
Right.
It's like, I have five sisters, a mother.
And how old were you then?
I was like seven, man.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And you know, coming from an environment already in impoverished conditions, you already are thinking like an adult, right? Like, despite if, you know, they made it, I couldn't tell that we were struggling, but I could tell that my friends were, and they lived right here next to me. You know what I mean? Things were hard. My house was like the safe haven in the neighborhood because my parents would, you know, try to cook and invite people over. And this
every hood got that.
Yeah, that
every
was my house.
Every hood got that house.
When I'm mad at my siblings, I'm going to run to DeSarte's house.
That was my grandmother's crib.
Yeah, they got snacks. They got a Super Nintendo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was my house. So with that being said, I saw the devastation of the neighborhood. I saw the effects of people that didn't have their fathers, right? Mm-hmm. And here it is, my dad, hardworking dude, but he was dwindling away, not from drugs or not from anything else, but just because of, you know, a health condition that he just didn't see coming, right? So we were all kind of like in the same boat. And that was the day I was like, I have to do something to help. And I grew up. I grew up fast, man.
Right.
So fast forward to Super Bowl Sunday of 2003. My father passed away, and I remember the day like it was yesterday. My memory is like a steel trap because of all these experiences that I've had.
Yeah.
I remember waking up, and you know, when you grow up in the hood, you like always got to be ready to play basketball.
Yeah.
Or play some type of sport, right? So like, I had my shorts on, I had my jeans under my shorts, just in case we went to the park, I had to get out the jeans and play 3-on-3 or whatever the case is, and I'm getting dressed. And I go into my mom's room, and she's like, today's not going to be a good day. And at that point, my dad was like really sick. They had a ventilator with the, you know, the oxygen going to his nose. And as a kid, I was scared. I told you I was a grown man, I felt like at the time. Before I went to sleep, my mom would go up and everything. And I would go to the ventilator and turn it up just a little bit. So I would make sure, like, you're going to be breathing the next day. And that day, January 26th, she was like, it's not going to be a good day. And I was like, why? You know what I mean?
Everything
is cool. You know, I turned the ventilator on. Like, it's not going to be a good day. And my aunties are in the house and they're African. So they got their head wraps on and, you know, they're packing all his clothes. And I didn't get it, you know? So finally, like midday, I think my dad's just sleeping in the house, right? Pulled me upstairs and said, your dad passed away today. And that was the beginning of like a pivot in my mentality, my maturity, you know?
Right.
And I would say like the rest of my life. So that was probably the first time that I felt like my mission has started.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm sure you've had that same experience.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this. And there's so much there.
Right.
And thanks for sharing that. But going back to that, just trying to draw a line to where we are now.
Right.
What is your first memory of money?
Yeah,
You know, with those experiences, what do you always, because I have them, right?
Right.
Growing up, what is your first, you know, thought or process of money?
Yeah, so
on time?
Now that I can kind of piece together everything that has happened in my life, now I can like kind of identify my first experiences with money. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one that sticks out to me. My parents came from Liberia. You know what I mean? There's no taxes or anything like that. Like, you're just really trying to make money, buy what you need to survive.
Yeah.
And I remember going downtown, not too far away from here, to a lawyer's office, and they had to file for bankruptcy.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Right.
At that time. So I'm like, everything looks cool. Like, we're eating.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? We're not like these other families that are like, man, we ain't got
it. Now, again, how old are you now?
Yeah, I'm probably like around the same age, like 7 or 8. Wow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And like I said, my memories are still trapped.
Yeah, right?
So
of course.
We're in the office and they're like filing for bankruptcy. And I'm like, okay. You know, that was kind of like my first like vivid recollection of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Just,
I guess we don't have it. I guess this is really bad. You know what I mean?
Right.
I guess I can't ask for things. Right. So in addition to my father having terminal prostate cancer, we're in this place where it's like, the finances must not be that great, you know? So I'm going to do what I got to do to not ask for anything.
Right.
I have 5 sisters. We got my cousins that are essentially refugees from the war staying with us, whom I call my brother. We'll get to that. And my, like, I can't ask for anything. So I'll tell you my first bid with entrepreneurship. They used to give me allowance, a couple dollars a day, you know? And instead of buying food at the school, I would save that money, go to Walgreens. And I would buy those packs of pencils that are like 20 pencils, right?
Right.
Because at the school, the general store was selling them like 50 cents each.
I'm right.
Like, yo, I can get 50 of these, 40 of these
right.
for this $4, and I can sell them for 25 cents. So instead of asking for like more lunch money, I would just go get my products.
Essentially. Re-up.
You know what I mean?
Re-up.
Sell them on the yard. I was like in third grade, and everybody's around me with quarters.
Yeah.
Because it was cheaper, right?
Yeah.
And I would, after school, go to this restaurant called Two Jacks and buy my cheeseburger, fries, and I was like the guy. Because I was like, I had all this food.
Yeah.
But back in the day when you can walk to school and it was okay, right? So that was my first experience, right? But that came from seeing that we didn't have money.
Right.
Seeing that I couldn't ask.
Yeah.
Seeing that I couldn't get the Nikes, so I should go to JCPenney and get the dad shoes, right?
Yeah,
so those experiences really marked me.
Now, what's also beautiful about this is, right, we were both collegiate athletes, right? We were both able to come from the circumstances that we were in, right, and go to college for free. But did your background play a role into, one, how hard you went? Because you knew there was no money for college, and two, where you actually decided to go to school. Because I think one of those two, I made a mistake. But
right. So I think that it did, but not because of the money aspect. I think it was more because I had a chip on my shoulder, man.
Yep.
My dad was gone.
Right.
I had 5 sisters. So the ticket in those neighborhoods, a lot of the times, is like, you can play sports.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that really was motivational to me, you know, seeing people who had done the same things and made it out.
Right.
And I wanted to do that, right? So that was kind of like my motivator for kind of taking that route of sports. And I was good. I'm pretty big for my age. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pretty skilled. And if I worked
big
on it a little bit,
now.
If I worked on it a little bit, I could take this somewhere. And that's what happened.
Right. So, and again, I think you saw this as well, is, you know, you, like me, went to college with a PhD, right? Poor, hungry, driven.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure you saw that in the, you know, in being around athletes who didn't have that hunger and drive as well. And that's what I noticed. But just on the second part of that. Mm-hmm. So, we were walking and talking, you mentioned visiting Georgia Tech,
right,
which again is close to my heart.
Right.
But did you settle on Cal because it was close to home and you wanted to be close to family, or was it just, it was strictly athletic?
That's a good question. I feel like after kind of getting the accolades, so I was the first All-American in San Francisco since O.J. Simpson coming out of school.
Man, why ain't that in your Twitter bio or something?
I mean, don't you hate those guys that are like at the barbershop talking about everything they did?
Yeah, but you're still young enough to get that
off. I mean?
Like, when you're my age, you can't do that no more.
Right. So for me, I had all these experiences and it was something that I was like, okay, I'm here.
Right.
My family's here. Mm-hmm. These people that escaped the war are here. This is things that they need to witness. Like, they need to be a part of this transition in this story.
I love it.
It was kind of like a decision for my family.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, hey, this is not just a win for me, but for a community that's behind me.
Dope.
That has pushed me, that has encouraged me to since I was a kid, right? Yeah. So that's why I made the decision to go to Cal. And it doesn't hurt that they're one of the best institutions, right?
Yeah, in your 100%. Backyard,
so it made sense.
Yeah.
It made sense.
I did the exact opposite. I'm like, I'm getting the hell out of New Jersey. That was strictly selfish.
Right, right, right.
So let's pivot a bit. So again, right, continue with this theme of weaving your life, right, in the intersections of where you've gone.
Right.
How eventually do you end up in financial services? And two parts, right? How does now everything you bring into this business affect how you look at it and how you approach it?
Yeah, so the first question is heavy because finance was not on my radar. Like, I wasn't, you know, some families have those times when you sit at the dinner table and it's like, hey, you should probably do this. Or this is how you manage your money. Or, you know, if you save $1, something I'm going to do with my kids, I'll match you 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just so they can kind of get in the mindset of this is how you save money. This is compound interest. Yeah. This is what happens. We didn't have those conversations in my African house.
Yeah.
Right. So I knew nothing about it. Football was my biggest investment. It was going to the gym, going to weight training, sprinting, doing the extra work.
Talk about
right?
it.
Right? That was like my biggest investment, and I hope to get a huge return after playing in my collegiate career. Now, when I stepped foot on Cal's campus, I was like a highly touted recruit, right? And in fall camp, my first fall camp, I tore my foot. So I'm out for at least 3 months. I come back, I'm like the guy, like making noise. Midseason, I tear my ACL. I come back. The next year, I'm doing well. It's like, okay, you might be okay. Tore my meniscus. So all of these things are happening. So I decided to diversify the opportunities. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I have to make a difference. I have to do something.
Right.
Again, my father passed when I was seven, or not seven, but when I was a young boy, right? And I made it my mission to make sure that everybody around me was going to be taken care of, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, I have to do something, right? So at that moment, I began to apply for all types of internships. I got to say, like, I was probably one of the hardest working athletes on the team because not only did I lift weights, go to class, in the spring, which is not our main season for football, right? Fall is when you're playing your games. I was working at these tech companies, right? As their sales director or, you know, intern or whatever the case is, really getting that experience. I did marketing internships, tech internships, medicine internships, just to figure out what it is that I wanted to do.
Wow.
Now, after not coming back for my fifth year, I got blessed with the opportunity and I said that this might be something that I could use to help not only myself, but everybody associated with me. And that's how finance was kind of introduced into my life. Over there on the shelf is The Intelligent Investor.
Right.
So when I stepped foot into Fisher Investments, they were like, you don't know nothing, read this.
Right.
The guy
sitting
next to me in the cubicle. And when I read that, I was like, people have the keys, but we were never given them.
100%.
We never got the memo.
Yeah.
So it is my life's duty as a professional to pass the message.
Yeah.
So I became like the Peter Pan of the industry.
Right.
Just saying, hey, I'm going to take this information and give it to the people that need it the most.
Right.
And that's where it started.
Wow. Amazing. So now how did you actually, now you get into the business, right? You mentioned, you know, at the beginning, as I have, right? And you're going to have more of it,
right?
I could tell you is a doyen, right? In the business. But how eventually did it become to the point where I'm a financial advisor, I want to be a financial advisor? Right now you have the seeds there, right? You said you wanted to take it upon yourself,
right?
To be the Peter Pan and spread the message. But when did you really say, all right, this is it. I'm going to do this. I'm going all in. And I'm going to build a practice around what I feel, what I'm passionate about.
Yeah, so I remember being at Fisher looking at one account, and it had $36 million in it. And I'm kind of managing this account with the investment counselor or the advisor on this specific client, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, it was like an aha moment. My mom grew up on a plantation in Liberia. Untold story where Firestone, which makes the tires, bought 1,000 acres of land in Liberia for 10 cents an acre, right?
Right.
And signed a 99-year lease or something crazy, right? Have been making millions of dollars to put tires on the cars that we drive, right? My mom was a kid, like, getting the rubber sap, taking it in so they can produce the tires.
Wow.
Take her scraps, go to school, go to the market, buy fish, buy barrettes for her hair, little things that girls want to do.
Right.
That's where my mom was,
right?
And then on the other side of this computer screen is somebody that has $36 million, right?
Yeah, that juxtaposition, man, in this business is tough.
You know what I mean?
When you don't come from it, it's tough.
I thought to myself, and I'm like, here I am, you know what I'm saying, serving a $36 million account, which is not a problem, it happens. But there's a community of people that have narratives, like my mom, who could never fathom that compound interest and planning is a thing. It's possible, right?
Right.
So I took it upon myself to say that I'm going to serve these demographics, right? And I think that really pushed me, kind of catapulted me to take the risk. So I said, hey, I actually wrote to them like, this opportunity was great, thank you, but I doesn't think that it houses my ambition.
Right.
And I made the leap, and that kind of was my kind of start to get this thing done.
Right. And again, the beauty of this conversation, like I said, being, older than you and having everything you're saying I've gone through, right? And you're starting to walk that path. Mm-hmm. So, let's dig a little bit.
Okay.
So some of the challenges that you face, and it's multifaceted, right? As a Black man, we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. But just in general, right? What are some of the challenges that you face? And I also like to ask, how can the industry help you, right? Because it's not set up. You're like, how can the industry undergird you and support you to deal with those challenges?
Yeah, I think that for me, I was like the one who filled the quota, if you will, for the diversity aspect at the firm.
Check the box.
All right, we got one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I think that earmarked my experience, right? So it was like, if I made a mistake, it was amplified. Mm-hmm. It was magnified because I made the mistake.
Right.
Like, you might not have been here anyway, but now you have to deal with this. So that was one of my experiences at that particular firm. It was like, I felt like I was walking on eggshells.
Okay.
I couldn't necessarily talk or do the things that I wanted to do the way that I want to do them, you know?
Right, right.
And I just felt like I had to be on a straight and narrow all the time, whereas, it was like a frat house environment for everybody else.
Nice.
You know what I mean? So that was kind of my experience at the firm. And I think that it hurt, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, talk about it.
It hurt. Yeah. It hurt to kind of like have to walk on eggshells like that. It hurt to kind of have to make sure that it was like an anxiety type of thing.
Yeah.
I was anxious about doing the wrong thing and potentially losing my job. So I wanted to, instead of having somebody control the narrative and control my destiny, to be able to do that for myself.
Right.
And being an athlete, you know what it is. Like, if I work hard, if I bust my tail, the reward is inevitable.
Yeah.
I'm going to perform to the best of my ability on game day.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that approach, and I think that really made the difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the initial part.
Mm-hmm.
And let's transition to now, current day, current time.
Right.
Right. Whether, the challenges of growing, the challenges of partnering, which we talked about, right? Leveraging technology and social media, even some of the tools that we spoke about, we won't name any, but the frustration with certain tools. What are some of the things you're dealing with now? And challenges that you face that a roadblock, so to speak.
There's a lot of roadblocks, but you asked the second part of that question was like, how can the industry help me?
Yeah.
Right. And I think the industry can help us as minorities in terms of advocating from the top.
Mm.
And I mean, we talk about this at Wellstack,
100%.
A lot of times we're yelling from the bottom, like, help us. We need more. Or there's capable people that can do these jobs. Yeah. And I feel like people are looking at that as like complaints.
Yeah.
Like, why are they complaining?
Yeah.
But I think that if people at the top, like we talked about Josh Brown.
Yeah.
We talked about Matthew Batnick.
Yeah.
Or Michael Batnick.
Yeah.
Coming and saying, thank you. You needed to be here.
Yeah.
We made sure that you were here.
Mm-hmm.
That type of advocacy goes a long way.
Advocacy,
and I think it permeates throughout the rest of the financial services
100%.
Industry. And instead of being magnified for doing wrong or feeling like it's a charity thing that you're doing by letting a Tyrone Ross Jr. come in your firm, now you're looking at people as equals, as partners, as counterparts. And I think that's something that the industry can do for us.
Right, right. Now, again, before we go on, like I said, to some of the challenges, again, that we all face now with our business changing overnight. But I don't want to miss this moment because I've experienced brutal racism and bigotry in this business, right? And you know, this is your time, but I will hit on it for this. And I say this, it's really important that this is said. First of all, there's an issue in this country with young Black boys who can't read, can't read at level, who are not exposed to what we do, which is so important. Right. And I say this even to, white male advisors. It's important that poor white kids see you. So they know that that's something they can do. And one of the things that I experienced was when I first started working on Wall Street and I started to have a little bit of success, they were like, you only have a success because you're fair skinned.
Oh.
right? And you know how it is within our community, dark skin, light skin. Yeah. And I say this and I mean it. It is imperative that not only black men get more exposure and succeed in this business, but darker, right? Darker hues succeed because, again, the imagery, what they see is what they'll be. Right. And the power of an image in this business is so important, right, which is why I'm such an advocate for you. And I hate that that's even a thing, because it's a thing amongst our people, but it's also become a thing. Well, now people who aren't from us will say that to us,
right?
You're only, you're comfortable with you, right? Because you're, you know, you can almost pass as white, right? And hearing these things. So, What, and just this question, and I couldn't wait to interview to ask you this question, but what has been your biggest pain point or struggle being a black male in this business?
Being seen as not credible has been one of my biggest struggles or pain points, because people will, it's almost like you have to play your chess pieces so precisely so people won't have a reason to not work with you, right? So I can be the smartest, get the highest score on the CFP.
Right.
I can know every tax code in the book, right?
Right.
But because I'm in the skin that I'm in, they'll say, I don't want to do this.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the biggest pain points for me, because you are training, essentially, for the opportunity to serve.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
not like 100%. You're trying to win something. It's
right,
like
right, right, to, you right, know what
I
mean? Right.
I'm not looking at you as my competitor. I am educating myself. I'm working. I am training for the opportunity to serve you.
Right.
So when that's all laid, this training comes and it shows itself, and you still say no because of no other reason but you're a black man.
Yeah.
I think that hurts the most.
Yeah. Do you ever want to quit?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to quit. I wanted to quit. So, like, the first two or so years of my business, you don't know how many applications I put out on Indeed. You know what I
Shout
mean?
Shout to Indeed.
Indeed, all those, because it's like,
right,
there has to be, so there's a quote that I like, and they say that most people opt for the path, the road, the clear road, right? But the path less taken is the one that yields the most success.
Right.
So I would think about that, like, man, I could go for the lesser, clearer path, but that wouldn't fulfill the desires of my heart or what I'm trying to do for a lot of people.
Right.
So I thought about it, man. I've worked odd jobs. I've worked, I mean, 2 years ago, I worked at a See's candy facility,
right,
packing boxes at night, putting on my suit in the daytime and acting like I wasn't just up for an 8-hour shift to get holiday candy out, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, these are the experiences of the black advisor, of the woman advisor, right? Having to do multiple things to keep yourself afloat until your business matures.
Right.
And I'm not sure of many, you know, I can't speak for people, but that's a rare thing.
Right.
That's something that I feel like many of my, of our people experience, but not many of other races might experience.
Right. Right? It's funny, you talk about that. This is why I always say athletes kick ass in this business, because we're used to what I call a high RFN.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this to all of the founders I work with. We go through all the other metrics.
Right.
I said, what was your RFN this week? Reps for nothing.
Right.
Right. How many reps for nothing did you put in? You know what I'm saying? And that matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dials, you know, walks, emails,
door
whatever
knocking.
The case may be. Yeah. How many reps did you put in where it felt like you were getting nothing out of it,
right,
but you were literally just building the foundation of ultimately would be that breakthrough.
Right.
So again, just you know, moving from that in the current times, and again, I'm a big, you know, technology head, as you know.
Right.
We won't go into crypto, I promise. But, you know, so the current challenges of growing your practice, right? Marketing it,
right,
growing it in terms of headcount, mm-hmm, technology. What does that look like for you right now?
I wouldn't say marketing. I mean, I write books, as you know. I blog.
Pay me in equity, go get that. The forward is really good.
I do a forward by Tyrone Ross Jr. I would say the biggest thing in terms of my business is not having enough hands.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So as an advisor, you want to focus on deepening the relationships with your clients.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I don't think that I can't do it all by myself. Right. I have help here and there, but I don't have somebody that my clients are growing to know.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think
yeah,
that will make an extreme difference.
Now, as a young advisor, do you feel like you have to use tech, like you got to be on TikTok and Snapchat and Twitter or to reach your audience, or just feel like that's your demo? Or do you feel like it's actually, you know, because one of the things that I saw again. Shout to all the trolls on Twitter. They had a they had an issue with our panel at Wellstack. They're good at growing a social media presence, but they're not good at growing a business.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, do you feel that tug of war of having to use social media or all of the the tech tools that are out there, or are you just trying to do whatever it takes to serve who you want to serve and serve them well?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm on a social media fast right now.
Right.
Right. So I haven't been on social media and don't plan to be for 40 days. So
until the podcast drops.
Yeah. So that's October 25th on the calendar. Right?
Right.
And my business has still grown.
Right.
Right. But I think that because I've created this lighthouse is what I call it, in a sense that if the clients, the prospective clients are the ships, I've positioned myself as, you see me there.
Right.
Right. You see that I'm here, I'm visible, and that if you want to know me before you actually come into the office, there's ways for you to do that. You can read a blog. You can follow my tweets. You know what I mean? You can do these things that are pretty much virtual handshakes.
Right.
And I think that's important in this day and age.
Right.
Now, are you going to grow your business on social media completely?
Right.
You know what I mean? There's
going to
be other
ways.
There's going to be referrals. There's going to be other things. And there's an older demographic that will not be tapped in.
Right.
But I think it's necessary.
Right. So looking, 5 years out, right? What does Burknell look like? What do you look like? So we got more books coming? Is there a partnership? How do you...
There might be more books coming.
Right.
Right. I'm open to partnering.
Yeah.
But I think that Burknell is going to always stand by its core values, man.
We were going to always... Which are?
A lifelong partnership with our clients.
Right.
Cost effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And just client-friendly fees.
Yeah.
Right. We want to make sure that we're doing those things. So, if the partnership doesn't align, it's not going to be a thing. I'm okay with walking this journey by myself.
Right.
In my experience with Burknell, just Burknell, the name means Berkeley and Cornell. Right. My first partner went to Cornell, love him to death.
Right.
But, it didn't work out.
Right?
I had another partner. It didn't work out. And I think that God was really telling me that you are supposed to walk this path by yourself.
Right.
I don't think that you ever get a vision without provision.
Right.
And I had to really learn that. Like, don't look for the opportunity to make this easier.
Right.
Carry your load. You know what I mean? Carry your burden, and everything that you need will be presented to you.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Right.
So I'm no longer, I think I'm aware of God-given opportunities.
Right.
But I'm no longer like trying to manufacture the next great thing
or
the next great opportunity, because I think that's how you get in trouble.
Right.
That's how businesses burn. So I'm really been trying to operate from a standpoint of like just having a discernment. Like, this is what I need to do. This is the calling, and that's the way that I'm going to go.
Right. Yeah.
I think that we haven't even gotten to my brother, but in 2015, I lost my brother.
Yeah.
He was also came for the war and passed away from complications with hepatitis C, 26 years old.
Wow.
You get what I'm saying? And that was like the motivation behind Burknell. So I think that I can do this. I've experienced loss. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I experienced pain. I've experienced heartbreak, right?
Yeah.
So nothing in this industry is heavier than that.
Right.
You know what I mean? The following year, another one of my cousins that was in the war got into a car crash. We all slept horizontally on a bed.
Right.
You know, our feet touching, us cracking jokes at night type of thing.
Right.
Passed away from a car crash. And it was on the news. His dad was a sheriff. The car blew up in flames. I had to watch that video. Like, my cousin was in that car. You know what I mean? We had to figure out how to identify his charred body. You know what I mean? So in terms of like looking for partnerships and things like that, I think that all that will be given to me.
Right.
It's not necessarily something that I have to manufacture.
Right.
My job is to continue to walk in faith on this journey and be aware for those God-given opportunities when they come.
Now, you've mentioned so much trauma, right? For such a young man, you've experienced so much trauma and things that make you grow up fast.
Absolutely.
Right? How much of this do you share with clients, if at all, whether indirectly or directly?
Yeah.
Because from my experience, again, my clients are like friends, and they know a lot of my story, again, because I put it out there.
Right.
And I just felt like if I was going to have success at some point and I broke out, I got to lead with me. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Getting it out the mud and paying with your skin.
Yeah.
People need to know that. So how much of you up to this to your client? Well, they'll know now.
Right.
Do you share with them in whether indirectly or directly?
Indirectly, it's been on my podcast. We have it on conversation, but it's not something that I'm leading with.
Okay.
I want my clients to know my heart.
Right.
I want them to know my competency, and I want them to know that this is a safe space. You come in this office, it's designed kind of like a therapist's office.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. It is, actually.
Yeah. But I don't.
I'm going to lay on the couch.
Yeah, lay on the couch and have a good time. But I'm not leading with that. But I feel like whenever I can counsel or help a client outside of money,
mm-hmm.
that's what we are called to do.
100%.
We are investment counselors. Half of our job deals with the money and planning, but the other half is about knowing a person, their experiences with money. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Their life.
Yeah.
You know, and just being an open ear to help them navigate this thing that we're all trying to figure out.
Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
No, I hear you. So wind it down. Again, I have one more question that we'll get to, you know, my follow-up that I ask everybody.
Okay.
So let me ask you this. How do you know you've reached a client and now it's a successful client relationship?
How do I know?
How do they let you know it? Or is there something that you look for in a conversation, or is it, you know, compliance with the financial plan? Like, how do you say, all right, now I've reached this client, this is a success?
I've reached the client when I'm in their like top five of the trust circle, right? Because a lot of people will go to their significant, their wife or their girlfriend. Mm-hmm. They'll, if you're religious, you'll go to the leader of your church or something.
Right.
You might go to the doctor if you feel pain.
Right.
And then you're kind of coming to me.
Right.
You know, like, I need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. What should I ask the sergeant? Mm-hmm. I think that is the way that somebody has bought in to what it is that we're doing.
Okay.
And that's been a real big thing. And then vulnerability, man.
Yeah.
This space is vulnerable. A lot of our dreams, aspirations are tied to money.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when they become outward,
yep,
with the things that they're feeling, and we're peeling back that onion as, yep, to what it is, why do you want to do this? Is it in vain, or like, is this some vanity thing, or is this really the desires of your heart? I think that's when you know that you've touched somebody's heart and they trust you enough to share.
Yeah. I wish I could mention my mentor by name, but I not. He always tell me don't mention him, yeah, by name, but he gives me so much free jewelry. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he said was, when you're in a client meeting and you know you reached a client, is when you have a meeting with them, investments, money, the market never comes up.
It never comes
up. Never comes up.
You know what I mean?
It's an hour, 2 hour meeting, and they've walked you through what they're stressing about,
right,
what they saw on the way there, what they had for dinner last night. He's like, that's how you know you reached that client, right, and they trust you.
They trust,
right,
you.
Right. And they're gonna open up the rest of their lives to you. It's not only about pie charts and, mm-hmm, the numbers, because they know. And he said this. He goes, if it's always about that, please believe it's not a tight relationship.
Right.
They're entertaining that conversation with somebody because they're keeping about the numbers. Mm-hmm. So the minute they want six and you're five, they're gone.
Yeah,
right. But if you can keep the conversation about other things, you're going to build that relationship, and they're going to trust you. And that's how you know it's a successful relationship.
But I think as advisors, we also have to be conscious of that as well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can sense that. Right. I'm never going to compete on fees. I'm, yeah, never going to compete on rate of returns. Those are things that I don't want to do.
Right.
And if you want that type of relationship with me, I think you have to go somewhere else.
Right.
And I'll kindly direct you to where you should go.
Right.
But I think that we have to have that discernment as well, right?
Right.
To be able to say, like, this isn't a good fit for you or me.
Right.
We have a choice.
And on that note, really quickly, mm-hmm, before we get to that. So there's a lot of, everybody's racing to zero now.
Yeah.
Right. Schwab, right. Yeah. You got Robinhood, yeah, at zero, which is kind of getting them there, TD, yeah, Ameritrade and the whole thing. Uh-huh. Do you feel pressure to maneuver, right, to change the ADV because of that or no?
Fee compression is a thing.
Yeah, right.
But no, because I know the value that I have.
Right.
That I can give to my clients. Nobody, no other advisor can necessarily replicate me.
Yep.
Right? There's a strategy. There's a feeling that you get when you come in here, you talk to me, that you can't get anywhere else. Nipsey Hussle says there's a song that only I can write.
Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So these are things that we have to tap into, that uniqueness, so we can then share it with our clients. And that's going to be the secret sauce that keeps them here for a lifetime.
Yeah. I probably would do more business if my voice sounded like yours. Funny. Real quick story before I ask you this question. So after Wellstack, mm-hmm, we're all having, you know, dinner with a couple of guys from the Altruist team. Mm-hmm. Shout to Jason.
Jason, what's up,
Jason,
man?
Wink. We're sitting there. He's like,
Jay.
Man. He's like, if I could only learn to answer questions like DeSarte. He said, like, he's so concise and to the point.
Yeah.
But yeah, man. So here we go. This is it. This is what we're here. This is what the people came for.
Big time.
What is the one thing that you are most grateful for that never worked out for you?
I am most grateful to have not been drafted to the NFL.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's just let that sit for a minute, because there's so many people.
Yeah.
Wow. I know that's taking you. You can see, yeah, that's taking you somewhere.
Yeah.
Dig into that.
I am most grateful to not have gotten drafted. And the reason that I do that is because I think that I would have been selling myself short, would have been selling God short, by not using every token that I had in terms of talent and skill set for just that. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think my mind was so encaged by this being the only way for me to succeed and make a difference. And when that didn't happen, I had to really open up my life, open up my thinking, and open up my faith to do something else. And I think that's the thing that I'm most grateful for.
Here's what's so powerful about what you said, and I'm getting kind of emotional because I'm much older than you, right, relatively speaking, right? 40 years old, and my dream is never going to come true, and I'm not at the point where I could say that.
Yeah.
And it's amazing at your age you have that clarity. Now, 26 years old, 27 years old, I was still going after it. But the fact that you have that clarity right now is powerful, and I'm excited for you, and I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Because I'm empty. I'm not there, and I do want to get to that point. But opportunities like this, and I'm starting to see it that just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
But I pray for myself, and I pray for anybody else out there watching this that are in a similar place that they can get to that point where you say, I'm glad that didn't happen to me, right? Because I wouldn't have been able to explore all these other things.
Absolutely. I mean, we are all filled with talent. We just got to tap into it. I think once you set your mind on a definite goal, the world stands aside to watch you pass.
Right.
Right. But if we're trapped by any person, particular thing, right, or location, it's hard for us to really dig into that. You know, it's hard for us to really manifest that. So the fact that that happened to me and the fact that I had 3 surgeries and over 100 stitches was really the driver for me to say, there's more.
Wow.
There's more, right? I want more for myself, for my family, for my future wife and kids, for my community, you know, for society. Yeah. And if I can leave that imprint, how do I do that, God? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm doing it. Wow. You're doing it. But we had to, you know, you had to release that. And it didn't go in vain. You learned a lot of stuff that's going to carry you so much further. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because at some point, track was going to end.
Yeah.
At some point, football was going to end. It just happened to end a little earlier than we would have liked. But it catapulted us into a place that we could impact the masses. So I'm super grateful for that.
The marathon continues, my friend.
My man.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This has been incredible.
Yeah.
See you on the next one. We appreciate you.
This was another episode of the Human Advisor Podcast. Visit humanadvisorpodcast.com for new episodes. And be sure to check out altruist.com to learn more about the only all-in-one platform for modern financial advisors.